You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 217A, translated by Catherine Krieger. It's Essays and Addresses by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Youth and the Etheric Heart. This is Part 11, entitled How to Rediscover the Forces Active in Nature. First small section here is from Rudolf Steiner's report in the weekly newsletter entitled What is Happening in the Anthroposophical Society? News for Members, Volume 1, Number 25. This part here is written on June 20th, 1924. A number of younger members of our society who participated in the agricultural course felt the need to meet together at the end of the conference, which they then did early in the morning of June 17. Speaking from the depths of their hearts, these young friends told how they longed to use their own creativity and work to approach spiritual insights that connect human beings to the forces active in nature. These statements came from the innermost souls of young people who hope to transcend sterile materialism, which separates us from the natural world, instead of connecting us to it, thus condemning our work to barrenness. At this youth gathering, I was given opportunities to suggest paths to follow for this longing to achieve its goal. And now an address from the Breslau-Kobervitz Conference, Kobervitz, June 17, 1924, would be his suggestions. The youth movement of today is again turning to the natural world. Young people in the anthroposophical movement are also seeking nature, but in the sense that they seek the spirit in nature. In the hearts of young anthroposophists, this seeking manifests as an appeal of sorts to the spirit. Our culture, with its roots in earlier centuries, has not been very receptive to this appeal to the spirit in nature. Of necessity, the spirit has gradually been disappearing from the unique cosmic karma of humankind since the 15th century. We are already losing the spirit, and it is easiest to lose with regard to the natural world. Death is inherent in the natural world as a fundamental condition of its becoming. You must not forget that for life to come about, death must always be involved. From the cosmos, every living thing receives and incorporates a dead, bony skeleton or other support structure. We carry death with us throughout our lifetime in the form of this non-living structure, which we cannot do without. In primeval times, people knew that this dead element allows life to receive revelations of spirit, and even Roman times produced sayings such as in sala sit sapientia, sapientia, wisdom or spiritual light, is inherent in salt. When the traditions of ancient instinctive clairvoyant wisdom were still alive, people sensed that the dead salts of bones and similar structures were what distinguish us from the beings around us whose lifeless underpinnings do not allow them to absorb as much spiritual light or sapientia. But now we are living in a time of transition. Young people who approach nature in the style of the last century, through the traditions of the 19th century, are discovering the death of spirit in the natural world around us. Nature constructs a wisdom-filled crystal for itself. We can be charmed by this crystal when we go out into nature. But we must also realize that gods must die, not earthly death, but the death of transformation, the transition to unconsciousness, in order to come to life again in that light-filled crystal. When we look at this dead crystal today, we must begin to sense that it shines with the light of divine lives that have been resting there unconscious for thousands of years. In our own souls we must find the possibility to discover heart-quickening light, which shines on us from the sun everywhere in the natural world. We must sense it as the light of the gods. Although it is difficult to express in words, what young people today are seeking is a simple fundamental fact. Wherever an appeal to nature resounds, it comes from these youthful souls. They want to remember and reconnect with the divine source of everything on earth and in the starry heavens. In their renewed search for nature and spirit, young people today sense a profoundly serious cosmic karma. Only serious souls can truly grasp this karma in the right way. Today, let us attempt to sense the world of the divine soul that has rested for thousands of years in the heavenly glories of the natural world around us. Seeking souls can find a great deal in that world. The young people of today are seeking very ancient human knowledge, knowledge that was associated with humankind as early as the ancient Saturn epoch. With the coming of the sun and moon epochs, this knowledge lapsed into cosmic sleep, a resting consciousness of sorts, so that its own spirit substance could form the foundations of earthly nature. For today's young, feeling souls, who sense this fact but cannot see through nature to the spirit, the earthly natural world is as if covered with snow, even in summer. Death, that is, unconsciousness, is inherent in this, in quotes, snow of bright spirit crystals. It challenges the human soul to sense the fiery activity of the living word, which dates back to even more ancient times, radiating from the earth's center deep beneath its soul covering of ice. Rousseau's time smoldered with desire for nature. In German literature, there was the Sturm und Drang period, dominated by the precursors of Goethe and Schiller, though its influence was felt in much wider circles. Let us recall the abstract literary appeal to nature that resounded through broad swaths of the civilized world at that time. Let us also recall the warm, intense appeals to nature that came from Rousseau's soul. Even today, these appeals move many people. Nature, we want nature again, young people were calling. But what came of these calls? With almost elderly and uncanny deliberateness, Goethe himself cried out, quote, "Nature, we are surrounded and embraced by it. Unasked and without warning, it pulls us into the circle of its dance." Close quote. Goethe did not want to become conscious of the appeal to nature that was so evident in Rousseau and his followers. When we feel our way into how Goethe then felt about nature, and how he approached others' appeal to the natural world, we can feel our skin prickling slightly. We feel the slight shiver Goethe felt in response to this appeal, which seemed unnatural to him. He wanted to be taken into the circle of nature's dance without asking, and he sensed that nature neither asked nor gave warning. The 19th century saw a rigid, materialistic response to Rousseau's appeal in the form of so-called scientific knowledge of nature. This response appeared like a realm of demons who first snickered as Rousseau and those around him cried out for nature and then laughed derisively as nature appeared to humankind in its extreme Ahrimanic form. This is the background of our present situation. When we seek a middle way, we are overcome by a sense of tragic destiny. Since the end of Kali Yuga, young souls have been filled with a subconscious yearning that is extremely difficult to bring to full consciousness. This appeal to nature must resound. The working of ancient gods must be found in the earth, water, air, and fire of the natural world and in all its shining beings. We must rediscover the ancient spirit in nature. But how can we avoid the circle dance of wild demons that answered this call in the 19th century? We must not be overwhelmed by them. The 20th century must not become materialistic. And so, today, the voice of karma in the souls of young people calls out, quote, if you allow the 20th century to become as materialistic as the 19th, you will lose not only much of your own culture, but much of human civilization in general. Close quote. If we can hear such voices at all, this is what we hear repeatedly and in a great variety of guises wherever young people gather. It makes many members of today's youth movement feel uncertain, pulled first in one direction and then in the other. Simultaneously present in their soul, however, is a certainty that possesses some intrinsic strength, though it is not yet completely clear. We must not allow this strength to be broken. Anthroposophy can help, because it believes spirit can be perceived concretely in all the details of the natural world, in plant roots, in the activity of light above the plants, in the warmth that streams its blessings through them. Anthroposophy also believes that the animal kingdom, which is in need of healing in many respects, exists as a warning call to humankind. Animals are present on the earth for the sake of human beings. Acting appropriately toward animals and the rest of the natural world requires the ability to sense and ultimately to acknowledge all of the natural world's individual spiritual beings. We sense this requirement whenever the need arises to speak about spirit, not in generalities, but in connection with the details of agriculture or any other human activity in the natural world. That is why I was so sympathetic to your request to share a few thoughts today. In brackets, discussion ensues. Even today, those who have found their way into the anthroposophical spiritual movement experience uncertainty and feel a need for strong support to find what they are seeking. Why is this so? What happens to young people who feel passionate about meeting other individuals in new ways that contrast with the transmitted wisdom of centuries past? Outer circumstances, at least, almost always force these seekers back into old channels. Since the end of Kali Yuga, it could not become clear, and apparently must be unclear, what has approached us as the modern, hidden seeking of humanity. Proceeding from nature, in quotes, to look into and search in nature, and to seek and search into the spiritual with the spirit. As you may know, our good friend Mr. Ritter has told us about growing up as a farmer's son and then outgrowing his peasant roots. Outgrowing one's peasant roots was something of an archetypal phenomenon at a time when some of you were not yet conceived and others were infants in the cradle. That was the beginning of the age of uncertainty. By now, agrarian life as it existed for centuries is nothing but a myth. On the psychological level, this life was totally different from our abstract science or our modern culture as a whole. The peasants of old were really much more spiritual than modern scholars. But in the 1860s and 1870s, this peasant spirituality died off, and one of the manifestations of its dying was a sudden urge on the part of farmers to send their sons to college. This abstract notion, which appeared in the last third of the 19th century, points to something very different from the old peasantry that knew how to live in and with nature. Of course, some sons of farmers had gone to college before, but they did so in order to join the clergy, not to become farmers. Becoming a clergyman was compatible with the consciousness and spiritual seeking of the old peasantry. When farmers sent their sons to institutions of higher learning, they were seeking spirit. In the last third of the 19th century, however, these students suddenly became poor in spirit, spiritually empty. The farmers who had insisted that their sons go to college began to realize that they were losing their offspring to a very different way of life. The most I can do is to hint at these things, because they can actually be grasped only in real life. In the spiritual deterioration of the late 19th century, the agrarian class developed an active antipathy bordering on hatred, of all things spiritual and intellectual. I am thinking of an amusing cartoon from a farmer's almanac. Although it was probably conceived by some journalist, it is nonetheless characteristic of the attitude among farmers in the 1870s and 1880s, when farmers' associations were being founded in Central Europe. This cartoon shows a representative of one such association pulling a pointed cap down over his ears and saying, quote, "We don't want no lawyers or teachers in the Farmers' Association," close quote. Farmers were no longer comfortable with academia in any form, including theology, and they thought the smart thing to do was to exclude the most common forms of scholarship from their associations. In the late 1800s, this view produced individuals who were actually mere images of human beings. With a few exceptions, the civilized world, at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, was populated by images, not real humans. A time had come when what should have been the truth was perverted into its opposite in a very strange way. It was enough to make your heart ache to see these so-called truths. A good example is the theory that actively encouraged overpopulation in certain areas. The fact that many people were being born was taken as a sign of real progress, and this interpretation, in turn, encouraged increases in population. From the spiritual perspective, however, increasing numbers of souls were coming down to the earth prematurely, and these, in quotes, spiritual preemies, never really found their way to the earth. They came to the earth without discovering the content of their essential being. Once here, they walked around like mere appendages to their own rationality, like mere shadows or images of themselves, estranged from the natural world. They were a terrible sight to see. Then, in the early 20th century, many of the souls being born experienced what was lacking in their immediate predecessors, and they felt the need to go looking for the truly human element. But all kinds of old social establishments remained in place to quash the souls of these young people. If our ability to reshape outer life were as strong as our ability to awaken souls through anthroposophy, things would be very different, and we would not have to talk about the need for anthroposophy to become, in quotes, concrete. In the absence of outer deterrent forces, we would sense how anthroposophy could reshape the world. Just think about how young people are growing up today. Dr. Ritter had the opportunity to spend his formative years on a large estate that remained spiritually intact, so to speak, while the materialistic world around it went crazy. This is a phenomenon in itself. But such a phenomenon is present today wherever an outer refuge is found for what young people are seeking. In every such instance, anthroposophy must stand behind it in some way, because when we want to learn, we anthroposophists do not study in the sense of striving for rational understanding, but rather we become priests, in quotes, in the best sense of the word. And when the transition from the old priesthood, which has become a falsehood, to the new priesthood, happens remarkably fast, then it becomes quite noticeable. For instance, what happened in Köfering is quite remarkable. Anthroposophy shaped first the landowner and then the estate. In our hearts, we must learn to transform artificially thought-out spirit, which remains estranged from nature, into developed spirit, which again finds its way out into the world of natural objects. That is why I have attempted to draw on actual experience during this course. Today, the only way to find spirit is to clothe it in words provided by nature, so that our perceptions also grow strong again. Now, in the age of Michael, you are on the right path if you manage to develop real reverence out of what is already knowable, but appears to dwell exclusively in ideas. Transforming such knowledge into reverence is the best path of all. Meditation means transforming what we know, specifically what we know about individual concrete things, into reverence, and the results are sometimes surprising. In making such statements, I expose myself to allegations of impertinence from those who grew old conventionally rather than spiritually in the course of the 20th century. Unlike you, they have no access to the profound feelings that arise when we realize that the human brain develops similarly to manure, but in a different direction. You also sense that this manure substance is given back to the forces that shape the cosmos. It is received by spirit, as the human spirit receives matter from within, but on a much higher level. When we take in matter from outside, we have no inkling of what we take in, along with the cultivated plants we consume. It begins to work in us with divine energy as soon as it touches our tongues and is transformed into taste. We are briefly aware of this sensual experience, but then it disappears from consciousness and reemerges full of profound wisdom. Within the human body, matter that is subconsciously transformed in this way ends up in the, in quotes, dung heap that fills the brain, where it allows us to grasp nature. We must learn that our task as human beings is to transfer this manure, in quotes, to the cosmos in the right way. This does not mean making mechanical toys for children out of compressed dung, which is how modern individuals use their brains. Instead of manuring spiritual fields so that spirit can work there, we use our brains to make machines. We must acknowledge that the purpose of the human brain is to manure spiritual fields for the gods who descend to humankind. Considering the brain in this inner light leads to awe and wonder as we learn to divine what is happening in our unconscious and subconscious. We become aware that nature is created in the image of the human being. If we see nature in association with manure, we slowly and gradually become aware of the unconscious workings of the human body. From within ourselves, we learn to renew the faith that has long since become mere tradition. In our Roman-influenced age, faith, like so much of what comes down to us from ancient nature-imbued clairvoyant times, is not understood. For example, consider the saying, Naturalia non sunt turpia. Natural things are not shameful. All things in nature are beautiful. If they do not seem so to us, it is simply because we cannot see or smell their beauty. Let us compare ancient and modern attitudes in this regard. Looking at Western culture as a whole, washing is a large part of how we in the West imitate nature. Of course, washing is a good thing, but in Europe and America, we do enough of it to wash nature away altogether. We dull our senses with washing. You may recall that the ancient Egyptians also did a great deal of washing. Their purification was somewhat forgotten in Greece, though it was reflected to some extent in the concept of catharsis. What does all this mean? It means that when we are surrounded by the natural world of the Earth's surface, we are in the belly of the cosmic being. Knowing this, we regain a sensation that I myself experienced only as a very small child among metal miners in the mountains. Some of them knew that they encountered spirits underground that could not be found on the surface. They encountered the living thinking of the earth's interior, the organs with which the earth dreams and thinks about the universe. When miners looked heavenward, they saw abstract stars, but when they became somewhat familiar with what lay beneath the earth's surface, they saw truly living images. When we succeed in restoring this element of feeling to our cognition, which had become dead and desolate by the end of Kali Yuga, we gradually free ourselves from the shackles of time that constrain abstract thinkers. This is why I repeatedly point to anthroposophy as something that will allow you young people to connect with each other with special intensity. Anthroposophy first appeared to people who grew up surrounded by godless thinking, and these people also approached anthroposophy abstractly. Consequently, anthroposophy was well understood in the early 20th century, but in a rather abstract way. By destiny, not coincidence, the first anthroposophists were retirees. Those of us responsible for anthroposophy experienced repeatedly that people still active in ordinary careers in our culture might be attracted to anthroposophy, but did not become anthroposophists, somehow imagining that they might be of more use to anthroposophy if they did not become members. Typically, they joined only after they retired. We experienced a certain tragedy in the influx of members of this age group. Then came a very difficult time, the second decade of the 20th century, when middle-aged people should have become active but failed to do so. These middle-aged people were left dangling between getting their doctorates and retirement, so to speak, though we saw this phenomenon among proletarians and farmers as well as academics. They never really found their direction. To be sure, they were members of the Anthroposophical Society. They saw the need for activity based on anthroposophy. Then they faced the need to develop a threefold order in the body social as a dwelling place for spirit nature. If threefold social order had captured their hearts, this would have happened, but it failed. We were dealing with adults, people who had finished school but were not yet retired. This is the unique tragedy of that generation. In any case, it proved impossible to move forward, and the more so because that generation stands there like an abyss between retirees and young people who no longer have much respect for diplomas. Nowadays, people get diplomas as a matter of habit, but in the 1860s and 1870s, diplomas hanging on the wall counted for much more than actual spirit-pervaded, flesh-and-blood human beings. This attitude has vanished. When I meet young people today, I often have to think of a friend I met when he was in his late 50s. At the age of 46, having become something of a success in a small city, he wanted to marry the woman he had fallen in love with at age 18. But the church containing his birth registry had burned down, and he was unable to marry because he could not obtain a birth certificate. At that time, you had to be entered in a registry somewhere and get certificates to prove that you existed. No one paid any attention to your actual presence. All that counted was the official documents saying you exist. Young people today are no longer so impressed with certificates, diplomas, and other forms of documentation because they have no faith in the competence of those issuing them. More typical today is the enthusiastic striving of more spiritually inclined young people, including proletarians. But these young people feel separated from old people as if by an abyss, and that abyss is made up of middle-aged adults who were between the ages of 25 and 48 during the first decade of the 20th century. Individuals in that generation had an excellent chance of not remaining human, of being reduced to the trappings of their class or profession. But for young people with their yearning for real life experience, the point is not to continue to transform anthroposophy into abstractions, ideas, concepts, or even fields of study, but to actually act out of an anthroposophically based understanding of the natural world. This is what I wanted to emphasize especially strongly today. We say we are forging the sword of Michael, but there is more to it than that. In the esoteric world, the Michaelic sword we are forging must be placed on an invisible underground altar, where it can be found by receptive souls. This is what we learn as we become familiar with subterranean natural powers. You can help make it possible for increasing numbers of souls to find the sword of Michael. Forging this sword is not enough. We accomplish something worthwhile only by making it possible for people to find it. As young people, you must be strong yet modest in the conviction that you are karmically called upon to seek and find Michael's sword. That will give you what you are looking for in gatherings like today's. And it will also help you understand what I said today about anthroposophy and the difficulties of those left hanging between getting their doctorates and retirement. If you think of it in great images, that is, in an appropriately instinctive and pictorial way, so that the terrible Ahrimanic spirit of abstraction cannot touch you, you will then understand, as people in the 19th century did not, why two words, wander and Vogel, were combined to describe the striving of young people. When we hear these words today, we wonder whether any modern traveler understands what wandering meant in ancient times. We must hearken back to a pictorial form of soul experience. Does anyone thinking about birds today know that we must do as Siegfried did in order to understand the language of birds? To understand the Wandervogel, we must first understand Wotan and Siegfried. We must move away from an abstract conception of the Wandervogel to Wotan, who lives in the surging wind and clouds and waves of the earth's body, and to the hidden language of birds. We learn this language by activating Siegfried's power of recollection within ourselves. Along with his sword, which is simply a prophetic precursor of the sword of Michael. We must find the way from wandering to Wotan to Siegfried, the way that once again makes us receptive to believing in the secret language of birds. This is a path that you all have sensed. If you sense it deep within your souls, you will also find it possible to sense the natural world and to know these things. And if you then also dream a bit, you will learn to live in nature with your heavenly dreams. Initially, we can dream our way into nature through sensing and feeling without thinking about it. Your efforts in this regard will allow you to form a community after your own hearts. And after taking a number of steps together, you will find that what you are looking for. May we keep this possibility alive in our consciousness and allow it to fill our souls. The end of part 11.